This Week in Radio Tech is supported by Violet Microphones, handcrafted in Latvia for generations, on the web at violetusa.com, and by the Broadcaster's Desktop Resource, a reference for broadcast engineers, on the web at thebdr.net.
And now, our feature presentation.
Twirt.
It was a very interesting way to do it. Like I said, it looked weird, but boy, did it work well.
That is probably the most rewarding part of my job.
All right, calm down. He says that to everyone.
This calls for immediate discussion.
What you
can? Yeah, all your data belong to us.
From his palatial office of important business.
Or in a choice hotel in a distant land.
This is Kirk Harnack.
Round up the roadies. It's remote time with Chris Tarr, Chris Tobin, and Tom Ray on Twerk.
You're dialed in to This Week in Radio Tech.
Hello and welcome into This Week in Radio Tech. You've tuned into the show where we talk about audio engineering. We talk about RF engineering. We talk about all things that happen in a radio station. Sometimes it's not all engineering, but the things that engineers have to do. And sometimes we move into the area of audio streaming and the metadata that goes along with that, satellite remote broadcasting. In fact, on this show, we're going to talk about how we get audio from live broadcasts out in the field back to the studio so it can be mixed in with the other stuff and then out to the listeners. And we have some pretty interesting technologies for doing that. And along with those technologies, we have some pretty interesting co-hosts. Let's check in with Tom Ray from the Hudson Valley of New York. Hey, Tom.
Hey, Kirk. They don't let me out into the field anymore. They just don't trust me. And well, what can I tell you? No, I'm a VP of Engineering for Buckley Broadcasting, and I work out of WOR Radio in New York. And it is a pleasure, as always, to be here with everyone.
Well, thanks, and pleasure to have you here. Also from New York, it's a man who's done many remote broadcasts, and he's a little remote himself. It's Chris Tobin. Hey, Chris.
Yeah, I've been known to be remote. Hey, who knows? I'm broadcast technologist at the CBS radio stations here in New York City, six stations in total, three AMs and three FMs, and we have a good time. So I'm looking forward to a nice, fun time this evening with sports remotes and remotes in general.
And speaking of remote, the guy way out in the hinterlands from Cucamonga, Wisconsin, it's Chris Tarr.
Let me look out and take a look at the cows out in the back 40 there. Okay. yes, Chris Tarr here, president accounted for. I'm a director of engineering for Intercom's radio stations in Madison and Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Well, good. I'm sure you have done plenty of remote broadcasts, both in the summer and the winter and the pouring rain and the freezing cold, right?
Oh, we've been known to do one or two, yeah.
Well, we're going to have some wild stories about those, too. And I'm Kirk Harnack. My regular full-time job is the folks at Telos, Omnia, and Axia somehow let me be in charge of sales and some technical education there. And I appreciate them very much for that. And also the folks at Omnia are a sponsor of the show. But we're going to do some more information about that next week. So let's get right into the subject of remote broadcasting. Also, in the industry, we used to always call this remote pickup. And it's whenever we go outside the studio to broadcast. By the way, in other countries, they often have a different word for, a different phrase for what we call live remote broadcasting. In a lot of other countries, they call this OB, or outside broadcast. And so when I'm dealing with friends and engineers in other countries, a lot of times they'll be referring to an OB van. Of course, I'm thinking obstetrics when I first took the job. I was talking to people in Australia and South Africa and Germany and Russia about their remote broadcasts. They call it OB vans. And it took me a minute to figure out and to really get that as part of my lexicon. I want to pop up a picture here. I think Burke has this picture for us that Tom provided. And this is remote broadcasting from the other end. This is the receive end. There we go. Tom, what's going on here?
This is what you might call your basic hardcore football fan. My son and I went to the Giants and Tennessee Titans game over the weekend, and we were walking through the parking lot.
Who won that game, Tom?
It wasn't the Giants. Who played like, never mind, this is supposed to be a family podcast.
Tom, do you mean the winner was the team from Tennessee?
Unfortunately, yes.
What, the ones from Nashville, Tennessee?
And it wasn't Eli Manning's fault. He played a great game. The rest of the team, let's just say that I had a clothespin on my nose by the end of the game.
I'm such a I shouldn't kid because I'm such a sports idiot. I barely know who the Giants are and who the Titans are. So you guys can poke your fun at me on that issue. So Tom, we will. These guys I had a tailgate party, right?
Oh yeah, well the whole parking lot, if you've never been to a pro football game before, especially in New York, the whole parking lot, people have their barbecues, they're throwing footballs, they're laughing it up, they're having some brews, they're having a great time. When my son and I were walking through the parking lot back to the car, and we saw this on the other side of the truck where the people are standing, they've got a 42-inch LCD television, and what they did after the game, I mean, this is 4:15 in the afternoon, and there's a generator on the side of the truck that you're seeing here. At 4:15 in the afternoon, the game ends, they go out, they fire up the barbecues again, because they don't get thrown out of the parking lot. The parking lot's open for a while, and they have supper, and they were watching the Jets game, because the Jets had just started, but they brought their HD DirecTV dish. I mean, it doesn't get much more hardcore than that, does it?
No, it doesn't. So, but we're here to talk about the other end of things, right? We're here to talk about the end of the getting the signal from the stadium back to the studio, so it can be disseminated from there. And I want to start out with Chris Tarr. Chris, I'm just going to pop this on you, but you're perfectly capable. Why don't you give us a little tutorial in broadcast remotes? Maybe starting with your earliest experiences, what kind of gear were you using and what kind of remote broadcast were you doing?
Well, back in the day, you know, and you'll still hear this, a common phrase you'll hear is Marty, and it's actually a brand name now owned by Broadcast Electronics, but it came to be kind of like Kleenex. Everybody talks about Marty. And what that is it's a microwave link. They call it RPU, remote pickup unit. And typically it's a transmitter. There's UHF and VHF, typically, you know, 150 megahertz or somewhere in the 400 megahertz range. And what that is it's a microwave link. You put up a transmit antenna. It's just basically a small transmitter. And you aim that at an antenna at the there's one right there. And you aim it at the receive site, which is typically the radio station.
Have you used one of these? This is an old
one. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. No, that's I used one of those. I still have one of those. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
They're great units. But you know, that's actually less and less you see that nowadays, especially with all the noise getting up on the bands and things like that and coordination issues. But back in the day, that's all we used typically because you had great audio fidelity. They were pretty easy to maintain. They worked pretty well. They're pretty easy to set up, you know, but it is expensive. And when they break, it's, you know, generally a pain in the butt to fix them. So you also need line of sight, and you know, there's a lot of elements to make that work really, really well. You know, we still use them today if we can get good shots, but that's been replaced by IP, internet, Wi-Fi, also what we call POTS codecs, or basically dedicated computers that use phone line, dial-up, not turn on until it's attached.
Why would the engineer have written in indelible marker that warning on the front of this unit?
Well, the reason is, let me tell you, is a lot of times it's not the engineer that goes out to the site to set these up. It's usually the promotion staff, interns, things like that. And very often they like to forget to hook up the antenna and they turn the power on and the transmitter feeds into nothing, which ends up killing it and smoking it, lets out the magic smoke. So, yeah, you'll see a lot of those. You'll also hear stories about people leaving masts up in vehicles. They have the pneumatic masts to get the transmit antenna up. They forget to bring it down, put the van in drive away until you hit that first freeway overpass and the thing gets ripped out. So those are just some of the fun we used to have with the Marty system. And that's why a lot of people are moving to IP codecs now.
Let me stop you just a second, though, and I want to backtrack a bit. Probably at least half of our audience now knows what we mean by a Marty unit, but some people probably don't. And I'll go ahead and butt in and say it maybe more plainly if you already said it, that a Marty transmitter, and this is a brand name like Kleenex, like you said, a Marty transmitter transmits on usually a VHF or UHF frequency, like the 150 megahertz band, or maybe the 455 megahertz band. And there are a few frequencies in there that are available to broadcasters, both radio broadcasters and TV broadcasters. So TV stations have used these as well to talk to remote trucks back and forth, although now they typically will use cell phones. And, you know, I always really liked the whole idea of of using these frequencies, because as Chris said, you could get really good quality. There were some channels that were more narrow and they would be more of a voice grade quality, but then you could also apply for a wider channel or combine a couple of channels as they did in later years and have the ability to transmit pretty good quality audio, like on the order of 10 or 12 or even 15 kilohertz of audio. Yes, it's analog. Yeah, go ahead.
In fact, there are a lot of back when AM music radio was king, there are a lot of AM radio stations that used to do live record remotes where they'd actually play music for dances and things live with the turntables and the mixer and everything at the remote location and feed all of that audio through the Marty system.
Sure. And listen, I engineered for years in Mississippi, and there were in Mississippi along U.S. Highway 61, Blues Highway, there's all these juke joints, right? And they all play blues music. Some of them play rap and hip hop music. Not so many country music places, but some of these places had a standing remote. You know, every Saturday night, every Friday night, the place was on the air live with the local hip hop station or the local blues radio station, and so they had a permanent installation of a Marty transmitter and a telephone pole with an antenna, 150 megahertz or 450, pointing back at the studio. And they'd be on the air 2, 3, 4 hours every Friday night or Saturday night. Then there's plenty of churches that
I was just going to say the churches. Yeah, a lot of churches do that.
Yeah, so I mean, I've installed so many antennas on church roofs and put transmitters in a church so they could broadcast their services on Sunday morning. And so this has been a mainstay of so many broadcasters to get these things on the air, these live remote broadcasts. The good points about a Marty, if you have a good shot, I mean, if it's engineered well, you can have really good quality. It can be very reliable. There's no additional, there's no per minute cost. There's always a chance of interference, but if you're in a small town in West Undershirt, Arkansas, you're probably not going to get interfered with. Shoot, we did remotes in Memphis, Tennessee from the state fair, or the Mid-South fair, numerous times with RPU transmitters, car dealer remotes, even remotes. I've done a remote from a hot air balloon, on the old WKQQ in Lexington, Kentucky. Where I tell you, maybe it's not time to get into it. We're going to have a time later to talk about the craziest remotes that you've ever done. So we'll get into that later. But I just want to make it clear. There's a transmitter at the remote site. There's a complimentary receiver then at the studio site. And usually at the studio, there's an antenna that's up high, or maybe there's a steerable antenna that the disc jockey or the engineer can steer to the correct direction to maximize the signal from the remote site. So that's what this Marty stuff was all about. And Marty had a number of advances here and there. They had also some portable units that you could take, like a 2-watt transmitter out into the mall and then have the truck, your radio station truck, parked outside the mall with a receiver to pick up the portable transmitter that was also battery operated. And then in the truck, they'd have like a more powerful transmitter that shot the signal back to the studio, which may have been, 5 miles away or 20 miles away. It took an engineer to make this stuff happen pretty well, but when it worked, it worked really well, and some people are still using it. Some stations even have in the mountainous states or in big cities where you've got the opportunity to have repeater sites on top of either mountains or on top of skyscrapers or tall buildings. You can cover a really large area if you put the money into the infrastructure and the hardware. The downsides, you may get interfered with by other licensed broadcasters or by people who are just trying to mess with your signal, because it's not so hard to get a ham radio and modify it and, transmit on a frequency that a radio station is using. I'm sorry, Chris, I interrupted. I want you to finish up with whatever you had to say there about Marty's and going into IP.
Oh, no, actually, you covered a lot of that. And, they're still in a lot of favor, especially, as you said, in smaller markets where you can reliably get shots all the time and not have to worry about interference. But on the other hand, with the deregulation and more stations coming online, less and less people to deal with it, there is some maintenance that has to be done with Marty's and requires usually somebody with some RF experience to keep them well-maintained and legal, because they are transmitters. So they have to be on frequency and they have to be at the right power and those sorts of things. And as we move away from radio groups, especially in smaller markets that have full-time engineering, they're starting to fall to the wayside because IP codecs have become cheaper, easier to use, and a lot more reliable. Nowadays, if you can get a phone line, you can get good quality voice audio for remote. And you don't have to worry about putting up antennas, running wires, running long cables, getting a good signal. All those things are pretty much cast aside. If you can get the phone call in, you're good to go. And even now, if you can get wireless internet, if you can get cellular internet, we have a box that uses GSM for data to use it for a codec for voice. So, you know, these technologies have started to change. On the other hand, there still are days, you know, we don't use Marty's anymore. I actually use them in reverse for talkback from the studio to the remote location because of delay with HD and things like that. You can't monitor a radio station live anymore at a remote. So the channel we used to use to send down cues is now sending down non-delay audio for the audience at the remote. So we now use our Marty actually reverse, where I use the base station at the studio as a talkback to the remote sites. But there are still days I wish I still had the Marty system hooked up and ready to go because, you know, if anything, you know, you POTS codecs have issues too. And every once in a while, you know, you just can't get a good phone line and you get, you know, renegotiating and audio drops and things like that. And I think back to the good old days of the Marty.
Hey, Burke has one more photo to pop up. We'll chat about this one for a second. I forget what it was. Burke, pop it on up there and we'll see. Oh, yeah. Okay, so this is one of the latest models of Marty. This one is frequency agile, so you can move it around. For years and years, for stations were only licensed, you know, for a given frequency, one or two frequencies, however many they had. So there was no need to have a frequency agile transmitter and receiver. So Marty, in more recent years, made this one that's frequency agile, and you can, you know, set it to any frequency that you have the right to use. Hey, Mr. Tobin, tell us about New York City. Can you use an RPU, you know, VHF or UHF RPU in the city?
You can. It takes a little work, but you can do it. There are still some folks doing it. But a lot of us do it in reverse, like Chris does. I use the frequencies for IFB, interruptible foldback, or mix minus, you know, whatever you want to call it, talkback. On occasion, I have used the Marty unit or the RPU frequencies to actually broadcast from locations that we can't get POTS, ISDN, IP, pretty much anything. But it works. We've been able to do it. It does take a lot of knowledge and understanding of RF, but you can manage. But like Chris points out, the newer technologies are so readily available, you really can't justify going to the trouble. But it can work.
Now, actually, this concept of using a Marty system for IFB, actually, I first heard of that before HD radio came along and the inherent, you know, 8 or 9 second delay you have with HD radio. I first heard of this. A friend of mine was an engineer in Chicago, and he described having to use this for talk station remotes. And I said, yeah, why? Why don't they listen off the air? Why doesn't the talent at the remote side just listen off the air? And he said, well, because we're on a profanity delay. So we have this delay involved. This is before HD radio. We have a 7 or 8 second profanity delay. And so we've got to feed pre-delay audio back to the talent so that when a commercial is over with, they know when to come back on instead of 8 seconds later. And they can have some interaction with the with maybe phone callers that are at the studio. Had you experienced that, Chris Tobin, before HD came along?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I've been using Marty our RPUs for IFB purposes for years. Regardless of profanity delay or not, it's just been convenient. You know, you can get a couple of portable police scanners, put them on your frequency, and have ad hoc receivers all around your remote site. It's very handy. Matter of fact,
Can you, instead of using a professional RPU receiver, can you just use a scanner or a ham radio?
Well, yeah, for monitoring purposes, yes. For broadcast, the Marty receiver, you want the wideband capabilities for the quality audio. But yes, and we do it quite often. And what I find handy is when you get plenty of range with that over, say, of the traditional IFB transmitter packages you can purchase currently, which operate around, you know, 200 milliwatts at 600 megahertz. And you got to hope you don't find too many places where the signal can't get to. Whereas a 450 RPT2, a 2-watt Marty unit transmitter, you back it down to about a watt or half a watt, put a little 3 dB gain on antenna on it, and you can cover about 5 blocks, no problem. It works great, and I say that from experience. Yeah.
What I use for receiving for our talkback system using Marty radios, what I use that work great because you can get them real cheap on eBay is like the Motorola handy talkies. Yep. You know, everybody sells those on eBay, and you know they're made for those frequencies. They're public service radios, so you can find them easily at 150 and 450 flavors, and they have excellent receive capabilities. Very sensitive, reject interference. I find them great. You can program them up so that the push to talk doesn't work. They just do monitor only. And so that's what I've done. You know, $20, you take them over to the Motorola shop, they'll program them up for you, and you're set to go. And they work great for that.
That's exactly what I use.
Yeah. Sounds like Chris Tarr's tip of the week there.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, somebody actually just mentioned it. HT1250 is one of the radios you can use. HT1000 is the real basic model of Motorola HT, and you can find them on eBay all day for, you know, $20-$30.
If you get the GP300, it's got an earplug already in it, so you don't have to modify anything. The HT1250, you're going to need an adapter to make that work, just so you know.
You big city guys, you're so far ahead of the little squirmy engineering that I did. I just used the stuff out of the box and, you know, never understood the Motorola radios too well.
But Kirk, that's part of the fun of being an engineer, is you figure that stuff out and you get to play with it. I love doing that.
speaking of playing and figuring it out, Tom, you had a World Trade Center story here you wanted to tell us about.
World Trade Center? No.
Oh, I'm sorry. Did I read it wrong?
Oh, WTIC. I'm sorry. I missed the I. Oh. In Hartford, you had a remote that was kind of incredible.
Well, in Hartford, we have the Greater Hartford Open Golf Tournament every year, which was down in Cromwell, Connecticut. It's a PGA course. I mean, it's a big course. And we did something unique. We did golf on the radio.
Okay.
Which sounds silly, but it actually worked out well. And what we would do is we would get a trailer, and we would put it up overlooking the 18th green, which was pretty much the highest point in the course. And we would equip the trailer, and we'd build a studio. We had, and this was the days of tape, so we'd have a couple of reel-to-reel machines. We had a console, a couple of microphone positions, and in the back, we had a couple of Marty receivers with a filter can and a preamp, and we had a 5/8 wave whip antenna on the roof. Now, for the guys on the course, of course, you on a golf course, you can't go out there. It's not like a hockey game where if you're standing by the boards or a football game, if you're on the sidelines with a microphone, yeah, maybe you get run over, but no one's probably going to say much to you. You're not going to bother anybody. But on a golf course, you've got to whisper. And you can't be obtrusive. So what we did was we got a couple of backpack frames. Like you take out of you when hiking. And on the backpack frame at the very top, we mounted a 2-watt Marty unit and hooked it up to a headset mic. And on the backpack frame, we had a gel cell battery that was about this big that we would charge up overnight. And each guy had one of those. And if we had to key the Marty down full time, that would last about 9 hours, which was more than enough to cover the course or to cover the match for the day.
Yeah.
We had a portable AM radio to monitor the station. We also had a scanner because they would use a two-way radio with one of our other Marty frequencies on it to talk back to the guys on the course. And then we gave them a push button. So it would be push to talk. And they'd go out in the course, and they'd usually follow the camera guys, the camera crews from the TV network. And they'd go out there, and they'd stand next to the guy, and they'd stand like a statue, and they'd key down the Marty, and they'd just hold the button and go, "We're ready. Okay, Tiger's up to the pin. He hits the ball." And the nice thing about the Marty was it had a built-in compressor, so we could actually get the whispering audio. And then when they'd yell at the end, the compression would kick in, and it wouldn't overmodulate the transmitter. But we were able to cover the whole course. I think the only hole we had problems with at the Cromwell course was hole number 12. It was a little bit. There was a little bit of noise in there. It was the farthest hole from the trailer, and it was down in a gully. And they tried to stay away from keying down if they were down over 12. But, I mean, we did it. Gosh, I was with TIC for almost 8 years. And I think we did eight of those remotes like that. And it was it was quite good because they could just bounce out to the field, just like, you know, the network television crews, except they weren't hauling around camera cables, because what the network TV crews do is they'll assign a crew to follow, let's say, Tiger Woods, and they'll assign a crew to follow somebody else. And those guys, when Tiger's on hole 12, they're out with the camera. There's a set of cables they plug in. They do their thing. As soon as Tiger's ball's in the hole, they unplug. They get into a golf cart. They go to hole 13. They plug in and they stand there. We would just follow them around in a golf cart. And
they also, I bet, were very attractive to the opposite sex, wearing all that stuff on their back as well.
Well, of course, they looked like the man from the moon, and they were all set. Luckily, both the guys who were out there were married. They didn't have to worry about that.
They didn't have to worry about that. That's for sure.
Oh, exactly. But it was really cool because, like I said, we could cover everything. It was broadcast quality. You know, it wasn't at one point we tried to do it with two-way radios, and it just sounded horrendous on the air. But it worked out well. It was a very interesting way to do it. And like I said, it looked weird, but boy, did it work well.
I want to relate a an interesting Marty RPU story before we move on to other technologies. This was this was years ago. Had to be in the early 80s, like 1982, 83 or so. I worked at a station, WKQQ in Lexington, Kentucky, and they sponsored a raft race on the Kentucky River just south of Lexington. And we wanted to cover as much of this as we could, but at least the home stretch. This was, you know, boy, the technology at that time seemed so lacking. We didn't have cell phones. We didn't have ISDN. We couldn't get a phone line out in the middle of the field. There was a hill and a field that overlooked a big bend in the river. And this is the bend that we wanted to try to cover. So I ended up, we had an RPU receiver at the studio location in Lexington, and we had a receive antenna that was up pretty high on the tower. It may have been up 500 feet on the tower. So we had good coverage from this receive antenna. We then set up on this little bank of a hillside overlooking a good portion of the Kentucky River at the end of the race. And by the way, this is one of those races where you make your own raft, and it can be anything crazy as long as you had to wear a life jacket. But as long as you get in the river and it would float, you could paddle it. It had to be unmotored, of course, and paddle it and just see who would be the winner. A bunch of fabulous prizes, you know, like a night with the Rolling Stones or something. So what we did was we had one boat that was the radio station's boat, and in that we put a 2-watt Marty transmitter. And then at this location in a field, we just set up a table and a little Honda generator or whatever was had at the time, and we had the 30-watt Marty RPU transmitter to go back to the studio, and then we had the receiver for the little portable Marty. We brought that out with us, so we just made a link right there, like a little repeater site, and it worked. It worked amazingly well. We were broadcasting live from this boat on the Kentucky River, which is down in a gorge. I mean, you can't get out. It's like a radio free zone. But our repeater site was just in a good enough place for all that to work out. We had then another challenge. Several times the some salesperson at the radio station sold a live remote broadcast from a bar in Richmond, Kentucky, home of Eastern Kentucky University and, you know, party capital USA. Well, they sold like a Thursday night or a Friday night a bar remote, and that part of downtown Richmond, Kentucky was just too low to have any kind of line of sight, 28, 27 miles, whatever it was, back to Lexington. So we had to figure out some way to get the audio back out. Well, I ended up ordering from the phone company a dry pair circuit, like a burglar alarm loop. In fact, that's what I ordered. I ordered a burglar alarm loop from this bar to a cable TV head end. And at this cable TV head end, happened to be right next door to another radio station where I worked at. In fact, I did mornings on this other radio station, WEKY. And so for a few hours every week, the receiving antenna for WEKY's RPU system that they had wasn't a receiving antenna. It became a transmitting antenna. And so I phone lined on a dry pair the audio from the bar to the cable TV head end. And then I got the audio and plugged it into an input on the RPU transmitter that I supplied. And then it went up the tower to the antenna way on the top and shot back, well, shot all over central Kentucky. But it was picked up in Lexington, 27 air miles away at WKQQ. And it sounded fabulous. Of course, it was glorious mono, but the frequency response was just fabulous. It sounded like the disc jockeys in the bar were in the next room at the radio station.
And that's awesome. Huh? You know, I hear the story like Tom was talking about with his packs and what you're talking about here. This is what our job is all about, is figuring stuff like that out and coming up with that stuff. I mean, that's when I get to do that, that is probably the most rewarding part of my job is coming up with solutions like that, because these are things that theoretically you look at this, you look at the situation, you go, there's no way we can make that happen. It's impossible. But, you know, we go out there, we come up with these solutions, and they sound crazy, but they work great. And you get done with it, you just go, oh, man, I can't believe I did that. That's awesome.
Hey, Burke has another picture to show us, and we're going to yap about it for a second. Burke, toss that next one up there, and we'll figure it out. Hello, Burke. Oh, there it is. All right, guys, what's that?
That is a phone coupler.
Yep, yes, with a miniature mixer put into it.
Phone coupler and mixer. So how do you use this, and what does it sound like?
It sounds like phone quality. You can use it in place of a phone. It gives you the capabilities of a hybrid, so you can separate your send and receive. You can dial from it so that it replaces a phone. Gives you a mixer capability, so you can put, it looks like, two microphones and a line-level device, so say the output of a mini disc or a USB recorder these days. And two microphones. Then you have a headphone control. Yeah, I've used those. Those are pretty cool. JK Audio has a couple of different features.
Yeah, it's pretty convenient to use, but it doesn't. The expectation shouldn't be that it's going to sound great. It's going to sound just like a dial up, you know, voice phone line sounds. But if that's what your option is to do the local high school ball game or the remote from the you know, air conditioner store or the car lot, then that's a very good option to use.
And yes, actually, it'll probably sound a little bit better than a, you know, than holding the phone up to your ear and doing the game that way, because this is made to mix the microphones in, and it's not going to be a carbon microphone. It's going to be something, you know, like we're talking on right now, and it'll sound, you know, even though it's phone quality, it'll sound a heck of a lot better than if the guy were just screaming into the telephone calling the game.
Yes, absolutely. It's like doing a three-hour football game by holding a telephone receiver up to your head. That's awful. Hey, we've got another picture here, too, from JK. What is it? I've never used one of these, but I've seen them. What do these things do?
You can take the telephone cord. Yep, nobody's on the phone here at home. Where it goes into the receiver, nowadays the telephone cord comes out, and you can plug this into that box and use the telephone handset input on the phone as your input and output, and then you can feed audio or take audio out of it. It'll be a heck of a lot cleaner. Usually used either in a situation where you can't disconnect the phone, you know, there's no phone jack, so maybe it's hardwired, or you might be in a hotel that's got a digital PBX, and if you unplugged the phone set, you've got nothing but a digital data stream on the other end there. So this will allow you to put analog audio into that phone.
You know, and record from it, too.
Right. Yeah, you can record from it. I don't have a picture of it handy, but you can also get adapters a bit like this one that work with cell phones. So yes. if you want to not, you know, be at the store remote with a cell phone handing that back and forth to the person you're interviewing, you can get a little adapter. It's called a cell jack, or there's some other brands as well that have a cable that's made for your cell phone, and it brings the audio in and out of your cell phone jack. Some of them go into the ear and mic connector on the cell phone. Others go into the multi connector that does all the things that it does. But this lets you plug a regular professional broadcast microphone into the adapter, and that way you're back and forth talking with somebody, interviewing somebody with a real microphone, even though the signal is going back to the station over a normal cell phone circuit and will, you know, typically sound like a normal cell phone circuit. You guys find those handy? Use those in any of your remote broadcasts?
They're handy. We use them for spot news and spot sport coverage, but The audio quality is phone, so when you have so much other higher quality audio on your radio station, you try not to do these particular drop-ins unless you really have to. JK Audio also makes one for Bluetooth, so you don't have to find the proper cable to plug into the cell phone. You're going to match it up, pair it up with a Bluetooth, and do the exact same thing, send and receive with a quality microphone and headset over the cell network. We've used those a couple of times. They come in handy.
That's a great idea. Chris Tarr, did you have a comment, Chris?
Oh, I'm sorry. I was going to chime in with the same thing about the Bluetooth, and they're great for that. We do them like sports actualities, things like that, at you know, sporting events where you're just doing a quick update or something. They're great and real easy to use.
Gotcha. All right, we got another picture here from Comrex. This is a bit of a blast from the past, and man, a lot of stations had these devices. It is a combination mixing console and
yes, and frequency extender.
Yes, a frequency extender. This is a really cool concept. Tom, you're obviously familiar with these things. Why don't you tell us about a frequency extender? Single line frequency extender.
Single line, what it did was it would take, if I remember correctly, it would take the low end and kind of roll it off a little bit and take the whole audio band between about, I'm going to say, 100 hertz up to 2,500, or up to about 3,000 hertz, and it would shift it down to force it down the phone line to give you just a little bit of high frequencies. And then on the other end, it would shift it back in the other direction.
Oh, now, Tom, I thought it was the other way. I thought it
restored the low frequencies.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe you're, because I'm not that familiar with how the single line work, because I've pretty much used the two line and three lines capability. But maybe you're right. Maybe
the single line was a split band, like phase shift key approach, if you will, single side band, and it gave back gave you low frequencies. The high end, Tom's right, I think topped out at 3K if you were lucky, but it gave you some low end to give the appearance of decent audio, so your ear could discern, okay, I'm hearing something that sounds relatively normal. So it gave you back low frequencies. Very handy. I know a lot of folks that still use it. I also, by the way, have a picture. This is the
This is the three-line model. That picture there was the three-line model. Oh, you got the JK, the adapter. Okay.
Yep.
That's the Bluetooth adapter model. So. What? You just have this in your Manhattan apartment, you weirdo?
Yes.
Because he's a party animal, Kirk. He's a party animal.
Various things.
We're geekier than I ever thought. Oh, man. I don't think I can match that.
I can show you a Motorola radio, too.
Oh, no. Really? Sure. Well, yes. No, that's all right. Hey, let's see. I wanted to... Oh, yeah. Back to the picture of that console, Burke, the picture of that console. In the upper right-hand corner there, you see this is the three-line model. And,
there you go.
Yeah.
That would give you a high-end up to about 8 kilohertz, and actually sounded really, really good.
I've got to tell you, first of all, a piece of tech and then the story. Now, on the single line Comrex frequency shifter, the idea there was that a proper phone line has a frequency response of about 250 or 300 hertz up to a little over 3,000 hertz. And that's great for voice intelligibility. But the biggest thing that if you could extend one part of that, the biggest thing we're missing is the bottom end, because there's an octave or two down there at the bottom end that you could restore, since audio frequencies are logarithmic in their progression. Our ear responds to it that way. If we could give up 250 hertz from the top end of that range and gain it at the bottom end, we'd give up only a small part of an octave of audio at the top end to gain an octave or two, whatever the math works out to be, at the bottom end. So that's the whole idea, is that if you use this frequency extender, you send audio into it, it shifts the audio up in frequency by 250 hertz, shoves it through the phone line where it will pass, and then at the studio, it shoves it back down in frequency, shifts it back down by 250 hertz, and so you get back the bass response from the microphones that you're sending in at the remote site. You lose a little bit from the top end, but you gain a lot in terms of octaves at the bottom end. Well, hey, if one line is good, Two lines must be better, so one of the really popular items that Comrex made for years for use with POTS lines was a two-line frequency extender. I never got to use one of those at the stations that I worked for. Which one of you guys got to use one of those and can tell us about the two-line extender?
I've used those quite a bit.
Yeah, I use them quite a bit also. It works just like the three-line, but one line less. Mix of capability. The audio quality is very good, easy to use, and two lines were handy. Three lines, you had to make sure they somewhat traveled in the same direction so the Comrex box would try to line up all three for phase purposes. The real fun part is try using a three-line Comrex or two-line Comrex with cell phones in a moving vehicle. Now that's a broadcast.
Oh, boy. We've done the two-line in a moving vehicle, but not in not a three-line. I wasn't that brave.
I did three-line.
On the two-line version, one of the lines was shifted down in frequency, just like we described for the single-line system. The second line, it would split the audio, at about 3 kilohertz. And the audio coming into the Comrex box at the remote end would then get shifted up in frequency by, 2,500 or 3,000 hertz or something like that. And so if you listen to it, it would get shifted down. Yeah. So it fit through the second phone line. Yeah. So each phone line is carrying the audio it's capable of carrying in the band pass of the phone line from 300 hertz to about 3 kilohertz. But at the studio end, they shift these back the other direction. And so you end up getting 50 hertz, down to 50 hertz at the bottom end of the reconstructed audio, and then up to about 5,000 or 5,500 hertz at the top end. So you got what sounds like almost as good as, say, G.722 audio. You ended up getting pretty reasonable voice audio. Well, the three-line version, the three-line version took this even farther. And I got to tell you, back in the late 80s, I went to an NAB show with a guy that worked for me, Robert Benjamin, and we stopped at the this was a Gentner product that we don't have a picture of this, Burke, sorry. This was a Gentner three line extender, and we got a tour of this product from, I believe it was Dave Pedersen with Gentner at the time. And this was amazing. It would take three phone lines and do just what I said, except it would give you a grand total of 7.5 kilohertz of audio response at the receiving end. It would reassemble all this stuff. It had a little bit of ability, I think, to take care of phase anomalies, but I'm not sure. I'm not sure about that. I said it did, but I'm not really sure how it would do that. If it didn't have any watermarking at the remote end, how would it know to put them back together with some phase adjustment at the other end? There's a Comrex. It's got three lines. Was it really a three line system there, or was it really a two line system? Do you guys know? That's the PTLX.
That is the PTLX. I believe was the two line.
Okay, but
it was the two. You see the monitor switch. The monitor switch, line one, line two, that was the two line. Line three was there just for convenience, for talkback purposes.
Talkback. Okay, and so that's the same thing with the Comrex console we looked at a little while ago. I think it wasn't actually a three-line extender. It was a two-line extender with a talkback circuit, whereas the guys at Gentner decided to make a three-line. And I'll never forget, we got this demo from the Gentner guy, from Dave Pedersen, and standing with us were a couple of farm broadcasters from Idaho or Iowa, and they were thinking about how they're going to use this three-line extender to do the the hog belly report from the slaughterhouse or from the stockyards. And after the demo, one of them turned to the other and he shifted his overhauls a little bit and he said, this here digital's the coming thing. This is in the late 80s. I'm telling you, truer words were never said. This here digital's the coming thing. Words stick with me for ever since then. So speaking of digital, let's cover some digital technologies. All these things we talked about so far have been purely analog technologies. Even the frequency shifting could be done in the analog world. Whether they did it that way or not, I don't know. What was one of the first ways to get digital audio from here to there for a remote broadcast. I'll jump in and say, talk about my employer, Telos. They weren't the first with an ISDN codec, but they were the first to put MP3 in an ISDN codec and use two ISDN lines. Before Telos, there certainly were some others. I think CCS had some codecs that would work over ISDN using G.722 and maybe even using MPEG Layer 2.
So using did Comrex.
So did Comrex. That's right. And maybe not, if ISDN wasn't available, maybe switched 56 might be available, or some kind of a nailed up 56 kilobit per second service back when that was fast. Anybody use some of these early codecs?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I use the Micro 56.
The Micro 56,
from CCS, that was a switch 56 or 56 kilobit ISDN. G.722 strictly.
Okay, did you have to order that Switch 56? Was that indeed a dial-up type of service? And if so, didn't you have to use an external dialing box or NT1 that could do some dialing?
Yes, yep. You used an NT1. It was a V.35 electrical connection between the codec and the terminal adapter. And yes, you did dial. It was a Switch 56. In this case, was 56 kilobit only. 8 bits used for the data signaling. And you dialed. Yeah, it was clunky. Very new. Phone companies used it a lot internally, but when it came to external use by, say, broadcasters, it left a lot to be desired. But it worked. Once you connected up and running, the G.722, for what it was, it did the job and did it well, and it was very good.
We'll circle back to Tom in a sec, but Chris Tarr, in your neck of the woods, what was an early digital remote technology that you used?
If you're talking purely digital, we didn't use a lot of ISDN. We used mostly the POTS codec, which was digital in that obviously it was two modems that would dial each other up over a plain telephone line and do that. The very early methods we used for things like permanent remote broadcast is the 56K ISDN, but generally that wasn't a dial-up product. That was actually a channelized, almost like a channelized T1 type of situation, where you'd have G.722 codecs on either side.
So, Tom, in Hartford or maybe in New York City, what kind of access did you have to digital transport technologies from the telephone company? And what kind of broadcast did you do with digital early on? Just better quality of what you'd done with analog?
Partially. It was better quality what we did with analog. We had, in Hartford actually, is where I started with the digital stuff. We had Switch 56. Luckily, at WTIC in downtown Hartford, we were literally two blocks from the phone company's central office. And the phone company guys knew us, and if it was new and the latest thing on the block, they'd come racing right over and say, "Yeah, gotta try it." So we did... We found it actually to be a little bit cheaper because, with a two or three line Comrex, you've got two or three different long distance calls up. We would do a lot of things. One thing we did every year was the Eastern States Exposition remote from West Springfield, Massachusetts, and on a three line Comrex, that was three lines coming this way and one line going in the other direction. That was up all the time, for monitoring purposes. With the Switch 56 circuit, it was one phone call and we were there, and it sounded better. But we also started with the University of Connecticut Sports. We used to do football and basketball, and we would alternate depending on where we were. We would either do it with a two or a three line Comrex, or we would do it with Switch 56 technology, and it just sounded so much better, and it was so much easier for the guys on the road than having to do two phone lines and making sure everything was set up properly. They would just plug in and off they'd go.
Gotcha. Of course, a lot of broadcasters ended up doing satellite remotes. Almost forgot about that. Hey, it seems for a few years, a few companies were providing satellite live remote capabilities. Boy, when I first moved to Memphis, Tennessee, in the late 80s, I remember there was an anniversary of the death of Elvis Presley, and Larry King, when he was still doing a radio show on the Mutual radio network, he came to Memphis, set up shop right across the gates from Graceland on Elvis Presley Boulevard, and did his Larry King show there for one night or two. Wait a minute, you know what? It wasn't Larry King. It was Jim Bohannon. Jim filled in.
Jim Bohannon.
I guess Larry didn't want to I guess Jim did. Larry didn't want to travel to Memphis or something, but Jim Bohannon did the show. I met Jim, and then I met some reporters from ABC, like Bill Deal. But the live remote was being handled by, I want to say it was NPR Satellite Services, which at that time, at least that remote truck, looked like a hippie van with a really cheap trailer behind it. And inside the hippie van with the shag carpeting and everything, they had the modulator and the HPA, the high power amplifier for the satellite, and they would do a C-band satellite uplink from there. That had to be a little spendy, a little pricey. Seems like somebody told me that typically a satellite remote was between $3,000 and $5,000 per hour at that time.
Back in the day, yes. IDB, yep. You'd be spending probably a third of that depending on where you're going to and from. Then you had Inmarsat. That's another satellite technology that's used. In the early days, it was about $15 a minute to dial up a 64 kilobit connection, if you could get that. Usually it was they had an analog type that you could do, 56, and it was a little cheaper. But yeah, those are the two satellite technologies. IDB was the biggie a lot of folks used in broadcast, and NPR satellite services.
So one of the game changers that came along to get away from satellite, which was wonderful quality, but it took a slew of engineers and a truck and all that to get it all going, and was spendy per hour. If you were I've visited some radio stations in Boston or New York that ended up going to Ireland to do a live remote broadcast from the Guinness brewery, and ended up spending.
Still do that.
You know, yeah, they still okay.
Oh, yeah.
But ended up spending on the order of $10,000 to $15,000 a day to go do their live remote broadcast from Guinness. Yikes. So a technology that came along was Steve Church and Telos, which their claim to fame there was to make an ISDN codec that was actually pretty easy to use, because the interface box, the NT1 that was needed in a lot of countries, not all, but a lot of countries, was built into the ISDN box, to built into the codec. So you could use the front panel on the Zephyr, which was the name of the product, and you could dial the ISDN number from the front panel there. And then Steve was able to include MPEG Layer 3 as one of the codec choices. So if you wanted to, see, you'd have at the most 128 kilobits per second with two bonded ISDN lines. And so figured out a way to bond these so that even if the two calls took disparate paths from one place to another, you know, from Dublin, Ireland back to Boston, even if these two calls took disparate paths, and they could, things should match up right timing-wise for the data at each end. Had to do a little bit of buffering to make that happen. And then you could choose MPEG layer 3, so MP3, in either a joint stereo mode or a true stereo mode, left and right. You could choose MPEG layer 2 if you wanted to use MPEG layer 2 at a bit rate of 128, which is a little bit lower than it wanted to have. Or you could use G.722, and you could have different algorithms in each direction. So MPEG layer 3 had a bit more delay in the coding and decoding. So if you wanted to reduce the round trip time back at the studio, if you wanted to encode to send IFB, queuing back to Dublin, you would encode in, say, G.722, which is a pretty low delay codec. It's not as good quality, but the only people hearing that would be, you know, your morning show team in Dublin. So that opened up a lot of doors for quite a few years, and plenty of people still are using ISDN and ISDN codecs all around the world to do live remote broadcasts. I mean, even the Boston Pops, when they broadcast from Tanglewood for years, used Telos Zephyrs to get that audio back to WGBH-FM in Boston. You guys probably have a story or two about some kind of ISDN codec. It might be a Zephyr or something else. Did that open some doors for you, that kind of tech?
Oh, certainly did. Yeah, I used it. On many remotes, the Zephyr was, the user interface was the best you could ask for at the time, and still to this day is, and a lot of people have learned from it. I've used ISDN on an Inmarsat uplink. We used worked really well. And, you know, it's, again, it's probably been the game changer for everyone was ISDN when it first came out. After Switch 56, ISDN, be able to dial anywhere, connect two codecs, get studio quality audio, and go from there. I mean, you know, when you think about it. Now, with the internet as a new medium to connect point A to point B, the possibilities even have evolved to a higher level. You know, 128 was your max on an ISDN, or APTX, the 3D two box that came out for people who were producing a lot of post-production work for cinema. IMUX was up to six ISDN lines. to get 384 kilobits of bandwidth, so you have nearly uncompressed audio. So yeah, ISDN, the Zephyr started it all, and here we are today now with so many options. It's great.
Hey guys, this is going to end up being a two-parter because we haven't even on previous shows we've talked a lot about IP remotes, so we're going to have to pick this up later. Turns out that the NSFW show is coming up next on the Twit Network, and it's right behind us. So we're going to have to actually wrap this show up and make room for the next show. So we're going to do that. But on a future show, we're going to pick it up here at the beginning of ISDN remotes and bring that into modern times some talk about how to do remote broadcast really on the cheap. Because if you've got a PC, you've got everything you need to get good quality audio from one place to another, except for maybe the professional interfaces. So you guys be thinking about that. Hey, I want to wrap it up here and thank Chris Tarr for joining us from around Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Thanks.
Appreciate you being here. Are you still on vacation?
No, I only had a week off. I'm back to work.
Okay, well, listen, be safe tonight. Don't touch any high voltage, please.
I won't. I'll be careful.
Okay, you be careful. We'll check in with you next week. Chris Tobin, thanks for being here from New York City.
Okay, welcome. You're welcome. I just got to make sure I say thank you, Burke. Here we go.
Ah, thanks, Burke. And Tom Ray from the Hudson Valley. Appreciate your insights tonight.
Hey, thanks, Kirk. And we'd like to make sure we thank Burke. Have yourselves a good one.
All right. And I'll thank Burke as well. And thank you for listening. If you want to download the show, you can do so at thisweekinradiotech.com. You can subscribe to the podcast in the iTunes store. It's free, of course. And you can add your comments in the Speak Up forum on the website at thisweekinradiotech.com, or you can leave a comment on this individual show itself. We appreciate you being here, and we look forward to another great show next week with the same folks here at This Week in Radio Tech. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you later. Bye-bye.
That's all the bandwidth we can pilfer this week. Another tort has propagated, and all the transmitters and audio equipment live happily ever after, thanks to the handsome engineer and his kind, benevolent care. We'll be back next week.
Lord willing, and the creek don't rise.
This Week in Radio Tech. Subscribe to iTunes and you'll never miss a show. Search for This Week in Radio Tech in the iTunes store. Soliciting is strictly encouraged. If you like today's show, tell a friend. If you didn't like it, we were never here. Kirk Harnack's wardrobe provided by the Salvation Army and the Red Cross Disaster Relief Services. Hair and makeup provided by Penny LaPay Garcia Hernandez Weinberg.
He's unique, wouldn't you say?
I just want to get it over with.
This ends this transmission.
Tango, Whiskey, India, Romeo, Tango.
Signing off. Okay.